To start off, can you tell us your name, your position at the ECCC, and a brief summary of your responsibilities there?
Sure. So my name is Roger Phillips. I was a legal officer and greffier in the trial chamber of the ECCC from 2011 until 2018. And so my responsibilities were twofold. During the proceedings, I was helping to usher the trials along by helping to select witnesses and organizing dates and filings, and as well as drafting decisions for the trial chamber. And during when the proceedings came to an end, I was involved in drafting of the judgments in case 2/1 and case 2/2.
So can you tell us about any significant challenges you faced in your role at the ECCC? And that could be both on the international law side of things or the court's policy and procedures.
Sure. There are a lot of practical difficulties that we encountered. And one arose out of the number of languages that the court was operating under. We had three official languages for the court, and that meant that every piece of evidence and every trial proceeding needed to be conducted in those three languages. So that's Khmer, French, and English. That created a lot of resource constraints, but also it impeded upon the efficiency of the proceedings. When sometimes simultaneous interpretation in a proceeding needed to be through a relay, that meant that it went from Khmer into French, and then French into English, or some other combination of languages. This takes a lot of time, and there are accuracy implications for that. In addition, we had the translation of, say, a million pages of evidence, and that all had to be in all of the languages of the court. We had a limited number of translators, and this took a considerable amount of time and caused delay in the proceedings.
Thank you for that. Let's talk a little bit about the hybrid aspect of the court. What were the positives and negatives of having a hybrid court here?
Sure. So I think one of the major positive impacts was to have Cambodians, that is those who are most directly impacted by the crimes, to be heavily involved in the process. So we have cultural and linguistic and contextual knowledge that really a foreigner cannot bring to bear. So that, I think that was essential in bringing about fairness and accuracy and a manner of truth in this kind of hybrid tribunal. One of the difficulties in this type of hybrid tribunal is procedurally we're mixing and matching different kind of legal backgrounds. And so we have the civil law background and then a common law background. And by combining different aspects of this, we had a certain amount of duplication of processes and certainly inefficiency in the process. It was also a lack of pure understanding as to what was the ultimate end. I think that, of course, in the end, we want to assure that there's due process, there's fair proceedings, but efficiency certainly took had more difficulty in these kinds of hybrid tribunals.
Sure, that makes a certain amount of sense. Broadening that to the court in general, what parts of the court did you think worked well and what could be improved?
Things that worked particularly well, and this can be missed by those who are in a trial proceeding, just following, you know, the witnesses on a day-to-day basis. You don't see what's going on behind the scenes. And I can speak on behalf of the trial chamber and say that within the group of legal officers and judges in the trial chamber, there was a great sense of camaraderie, of an ability to work together very well towards a particular end. And, you know, there were very few disagreements within the trial chamber through the course of the trial. Of course, you know, there could be disagreements on a point of law here or there, but you'll see that almost all of the decisions made by the trial chamber were unanimous. So I think that speaks well to the cohesiveness and the ability of the chamber to work together. Other things that worked well were the court management section, their ability to remain sort of immune from any kind of political impact, and the efficiency with which that office worked, I was always impressed with. So, and it's extremely important in order to maintain a historical record, an accurate historical record, that those who are involved with receiving the filings, with receiving the and preserving the evidence, do a good job of impartially doing so.
Sure thing. Were there any lessons learned or best practices or recommendations for future tribunals that stand out in your mind based on your time at the ACCC?
Yeah. Well, as a function of the negotiations to establish the Khmer Rouge Tribunal, there were kind of an increased number of judges at each level of the procedures. For example, the investigative judge became two co-investigating judges at the trial chamber, what was at the Rwanda tribunal, a three-judge panel became a five-judge panel. The Supreme Court level, you have a similar increase in number of judges. That makes for difficulty in deliberations when you have so many voices that need to be heard, and reaching a meeting of the minds and deliberating on particular issues. So that is time-consuming and impacts the fairness and expedition. Well, let's say the expeditiousness of the trials. So that, in addition to the languages that were being used, I think the fewer number the languages, the better. A single language would be ideal. So I think those are they're two important lessons to be learned from this process.
Sure thing. Let's talk a little bit about your interactions with the judges. Was there anyone you particularly liked working with or that you learned from? And if you have any anecdotes on the relationships between the judges that you'd care to share with us, that would be great.
During case 2/1, Judge Cartwright was on the trial chamber. She was a former Governor General of New Zealand, and she was extremely charismatic and very good at bringing people together. So I think there was a certain deference to her on the trial chamber. Throughout both case 2/1 and case 2/2, Judge Laverne was on the trial chamber. He was extremely meticulous and detail-oriented, which was helpful in evaluating aspects of credibility and evidence. One thing that illustrates his sort of proclivity to look into details was that every morning he would get up extremely early and get a paper cutout and carve into it these very intricate designs and these pieces of art, really, but required such attention to detail that I really think that encapsulates his sort of personality. And the third person I'll mention is the president, Nil Non. So working in the trial chamber, I got to know all of the judges. It took time to establish trust between all of us. And so I think that working for the trial chamber for a number of years was extremely beneficial in that regard. But President Nil Non is a person who I think has was really dedicated to the work. He was hardworking. He took it very seriously and was involved in really wanted to listen to everyone, what everyone had to say, and to take that into account. So I think he really represented the best of the Cambodian judiciary and being able to try to look at topics impartially and in a fair way.
Thank you for sharing that. I'm sure there are a lot of people who are interested in the trials but didn't get to be in the chamber all the time who'd be interested in those types of personal things. So thank you for that. What about the staff interactions? Do you have any anecdotes you can share with us about the relationships between the judges and the staff?
I think one of the benefits, again, of a hybrid tribunal is this capacity building that's ongoing. And this is another thing that's kind of behind the scenes. And for every international legal officer, there was a Cambodian legal officer. And we worked extremely well together. And their presence was essential, given that their ability to speak multiple languages helped us bridge that communication divide between the judges. So this younger generation was much more fluent in English, some in French as well. And so we developed a strong rapport between the Cambodian legal officers and the international legal officers. And we're able to discuss issues and kind of prepare deliberations of the judges so that the minds of the judges might be closer together before a particular deliberations. So I think, yeah, just in speaking in generalities, this is what I can say.
Great, thank you. So this wasn't your first international tribunal. You've also worked in courts in Rwanda. How would you compare your experiences at the ECCC to this court and other courts that you've worked with? Any restrictions or freedoms that you found at the ECCC that were different from other courts?
Sure. I think one of the issues that there may have been some differences on is this ability to procure witnesses to be heard at the court. I think too much has been said and made of the difficulties in obtaining the testimony of the highest leaders of Cambodia, the serving leaders in Cambodia this time. I mean, other courts have also had requests to hear world leaders, such as, you know, at the ICTY, there were attempts to hear Bill Clinton or Tony Blair, who ultimately didn't testify in those courts. But what I'm talking about is the average everyday witnesses. And one of the problems or difficulties we encountered was the age of the witnesses and victims in Cambodia, because the events took place so long before. They were quite literally dying on a daily or monthly basis. And so we would have selected witnesses that we thought could be very effective, and then would receive news that they had passed away. Other difficulties we had, for some reason, I have the perception that people were less inclined or felt less compelled by speaking with our witness unit to come to testify than those perhaps in Rwanda. So we would go out to villages, and I remember one particular occasion, a man said that he was too busy to come testify because he needed to massage his pigs. So this was a man who was involved in agriculture, and apparently there's a species of pig that if you you massage it, it makes the meat much more tender, and then he can get a premium price by selling it in Korea. So, but literally the excuse that came back was, I can't testify, I need to massage my pigs. So it was a strange response. Ultimately, I believe we were able to procure his evidence. He needed to have somebody else massage the pigs, but there were instances like this that were coming up that made me feel like, well, why doesn't someone feel like it is their obligation as a citizen to find a way to come and testify, despite whatever difficulties they might have at home? For whatever reason, there was a difficulty in procuring certain witnesses.
That's really interesting. If I could follow up on that for a minute, I wonder if you have any insights into why that difference was there. You would think that it would be easier for folks in Cambodia to come to the court since it was actually held in the country, whereas with Rwanda, it wasn't. Any insights on why that difference was there?
It may be that because proceedings had taken so long in Cambodia, people had grown impatient, And it could be also that those in far-flung villages heard very little about the court. It was the court's own personnel and not the local police that would be the initial points of contact. And so it may have felt sort of informal that someone was coming in and requesting their presence, even though we had documentation. These aren't people that they knew. They were strangers coming from Phnom Penh. So that may be, have something to do with it, but you might be better served by speaking with someone in the witness and expert support unit.
Of course. So, thinking about future courts, what challenges do you see for future courts that are going to be handling mass atrocities based on your work at the ECCC?
Well, as you can tell from my comments so far, fairness and expeditiousness are always going to be issues. So the Khmer Rouge Tribunal, unfortunately, was quite delayed in getting started. And, you know, as I said, that had impacts on the ability of witnesses to testify, not only because, you know, whether or not they were alive, but also because of health issues that were persistent in old age. That had an impact on the ability of the accused persons to sit through long days of trial. And that also, you know, impacted people's memories because the events having taken place so long ago, it just emphasized the vital importance of documentary evidence. Having, you know, documents from the government, communications, records of meetings, contemporaneous accounts of what had happened, these are essential to preserve. And so any, you know, prosecution of mass atrocities in the future should take into account that, you know, if we're going to prosecute these mass atrocities, we need to preserve that kind of documentary evidence as a primary function.
Definitely. Were there any experiences at the ECCC that changed your perspective or opinion or practice?
Well, I obviously learned a few lessons. One is don't speak openly about a pending case. That was one lesson I learned. The second lesson I learned is that when you're involved in this type of litigation, any sort of misstep can be highly magnified. So I can talk about one instance that became public later. I consider myself to be very proactive, and I try to foresee problems or legal issues that might arise and address them before they happen, or make the preparatory steps to address them before they happen. And early in case 2/1, Ying Sari was ill, and he was increasingly often taken to the hospital for treatment. It became clear that he would be passing away at some point, although it was difficult to know when. So I wanted to make sure that all the processes were in place to address his death should it occur. So in order to make sure that everyone knew their responsibilities, I asked the trial chamber to convene a meeting, which I would discuss with the prosecutor and a representative of the defense and the court management what practical steps would be taken should he pass away. So at that time, there was some criticism of the trial chamber for having ex parte communication, that is, communication between a judge and a prosecutor without the presence of the defense. And obviously, this is ex parte communication is inappropriate. So in order to avoid that criticism, I asked a member of the defense support section to be represented there. I didn't invite a member of the Ying Sari defense because I thought that it would create a very contentious atmosphere as if we were back in the trial again. So I wanted to make sure that information was communicated to the defense, but that we didn't have any unnecessary argumentation. So that was my good intent. But what ended up happening is that after we had this meeting and discussed what steps were in place, and it satisfied me that all the arrangements had been made in the event of his death, a newspaper article came out the next day criticizing me by name and saying that I was holding secret meetings with the prosecutor, and that this violated the rights of the defense. So I learned a valuable lesson there, that first of all, we need to be very inclusive, that when we're trying to be proactive, you need to be attentive to what other criticisms might be there, and maybe think twice before holding a meeting like this in the future.
That's really interesting. Thank you for sharing that with us. It's definitely interesting to hear how all of those sorts of things play out. So not to get you in any more trouble, but keeping within the boundaries of what's been released to the public, can you recall any accused or survivor stories that really resonated with you?
Yeah, okay. I mean, there were many, many that really impacted me. The opportunity to sit in court and to look in the eyes, Kongguk Eve, Doik, to hear him talk about really dispassionately about all of the evil crimes that he had committed was very impactful on me, just to see what, I guess, you know, this kind of banality of evil. Apart from that, the victims' stories really were striking to me in so far as like the commonalities between different atrocities, like these stories that you would think in Rwanda, in Cambodia, and in other locations that there would be so unique, right? But the same things keep coming up, and these relate to this important issue of determining the credibility of a witness, and let me explain one set of stories. So there was a witness who came forward who was being chased down by Khmer Rouge and hid within a river. And he had to stay there for a manner of days, to the point where the skin on his body was sloughing off, which is really graphic and horrid and difficult thing to manufacture that kind of evidence. I recall stories from the Rwanda tribunal. The very same thing was happening, that people were trying to escape the Interahamwe and hid in rivers, and over a matter of days, just staying submerged within the water, their skin sloughed off their bodies. People who were in lined up for mass executions and killed and dropped into mass graves. And then miraculously, a single person will survive hiding under the body of a dead person, a corpse, push the body aside, climb out, and eventually survive and testify in the court. And so on the one hand, that kind of story seems completely unbelievable, but this kind of thing happens over and over again. And I don't know if it's because the humanity within those who are doing the killing actually prevents them from being meticulous in the work that they're doing, and that is the committing these executions, so that they really can't bring themselves to look through the bodies and to make sure that everyone is dead. I don't know what the case is, but I've heard this story of these people emerging from these bodies in Rwanda, in Cambodia, and I've heard the story in Guatemala as well. So it's, on the one hand, it tells you like, well, you should be skeptical and you should be like, could this really happen? But it also underlines this idea that incredible things happen, and just because it seems on its surface to be incredible doesn't mean that you automatically discount that as a possibility. You have to examine the witness, you have to examine contradictions or consistency in their testimony, and you have to look at other corroborating information. So,
Thank you for sharing that. It's interesting to hear context from other tribunals as well. So thank you for sharing from Rwanda. Thinking forward a bit, what do you think the major impacts of the ACCC will be on Cambodian society, both now and maybe 20 years from now?
Well, my understanding is that prior to the Khmer Rouge Tribunal, there was a reluctance of people to engage with this part of their history. And so my hope and belief is that one of the most important impacts of the court is to open up this discussion of what happened, you know, how people suffered, and how to avoid these sorts of excesses of autocratic regimes in the future. So that is my hope that will occur now and also 20 years from now. One of the reparations projects that arose out of case 2/1 was to create a chapter and a history book to be distributed throughout Cambodia, so that lessons about what happened during the Khmer Rouge era become part of the curriculum. And I think that's essential to educate the youth about what happened in Cambodia and to educate them about the importance of democratic and open government. And hopefully that can lead to dividends in the future.
Great, thank you. Before we wrap up, is there anything we haven't talked about that you think we should know or that you'd like to say?
I guess I could amend my earlier answer about another lesson for courts in the future. And this is a very practical response, but it's essential that the judges are able to communicate with one another. And it may seem like an obvious point, but in a hybrid tribunal, we had Cambodian judges who were mainly fluent only in Khmer, and we had internationals who were mainly fluent in their own language, mainly English or French. And we had to use simultaneous interpretation to engage in deliberations. So another lesson that I think should be learned is that it's essential that all of the judges of the chamber be able to communicate in the same language. And I think we learned early on in Cambodia that one of the Cambodian judges spoke English much better than the others. I think it was a realization on the Cambodian side that it was essential that this person, Judge Otara, be a permanent member of the chamber rather than a reserve judge. And so he switched places with one of the judges to become a permanent member of the chamber, and his participation greatly facilitated communication between the internationals and the national judges, the Cambodian judges. I think in any future court, it would be important to select judges based on their language understanding, as well as their impartiality and their understanding of the law.
All right. Well, thank you so much for speaking with us. We really appreciate your time.